You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, supporting registrars on trauma-informed care, presented by Dr. Wei-Mei Su and Dr. Jennifer Neal. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
Welcome. Lovely to have you along. My name's Simon Morgan. I am a GP here in Newcastle and a medical educator with the RSAGP and also with GPSA. And I'm joining you from a Wobbekal country. I'll allow my facilitators to introduce themselves in turn.
Hi, I'm Alison. I'm a GP. I'm also based in Newcastle on a Wobbekal country. I work with Simon as a medical educator with the RSAGP, and my other job is working with the Primary Health Network here, going out to GP practices and doing domestic violence education with the whole of the practice. So it's my second job.
Welcome, Al.
Thanks, Alison and Simon. My name's Bill. I work as a GP in South Central Queensland and have a couple of other hats, but I'll talk to you all later on.
So I'm Jennifer, or Jenny Neal. I work as a senior lecturer in the Department of General Practice at Monash University, and I've been a GP educator in family violence for many years, training people all over Australia, all health professionals in the area of family violence. And I've contributed to a couple of chapters in the White Book, our RACGP guideline on abuse and violence. And I'm also currently doing a PhD in family violence as well with Safer Families at University of Melbourne.
Hi everyone, I'm Jessica Wrigley. I'm a GP also in Newcastle, working at a Wobbekal AMS, and I'm also a medical educator with the RACGP and do some education work with GPSA also.
Hello everybody, I'm Libby Hindmarsh. I really love being a GP supervisor. I currently work as an educator, especially around the areas of abuse and violence. And I've done extensive work in Aboriginal communities.
So, hi everyone, my name's May. I am also a GP medical educator, and I also am the academic lead at the Masters of Psychiatric Medicine and Masters of Applied Mental Health Studies at HETI Higher Education. And like Jenny, also just commencing a higher degree of research as well in abuse and violence. And Jenny is the deputy chair of the Abuse and Violence in Families specific interest group, and I'm the chair of that group, following in the footsteps for Libby, who was the former and inaugural chair of that group as well.
Thanks so much, May.
So thanks everyone for being here, and we were really blown away by how much interest there was in this session, which I think is a testament to how important and integral that working in trauma-informed care is. It's actually a really big topic though, so we thought we probably really needed to define what we were going to talk about in terms of working in the space, and so we thought we would focus on specifically how to use a trauma-informed approach given the high prevalence of abuse and violence in the community, and specifically as GP supervisors, describe how you were going to use trauma-informed education with registrars and be able to support them in trauma-informed care. But we also felt it was really important for us to look at that as a whole of practice approach. So I noticed that there are a lot of other practice managers and practice nurses, medical receptionists, and hopefully what we talk about today is still also going to be really of value for you as well. And you will also leave here with a list of resources which will help support you on this journey as well. I know we did an acknowledgement of country, but I also would like to acknowledge and recognise those with lived experience of trauma, abuse and violence. And I recognise that even in what we talk about today, that some of us within the group may also have our own lived experience. And what we discuss here today may have its own impact of who we are. And also sharing those stories may also have its own power and impact as well. I recognise that we can only provide quality care through valuing, respecting and drawing upon the lived experience and expert knowledge of consumers, their families, carers and friends, staff in the local communities. And hopefully that's what today's meeting will bring together as well. We probably estimate that probably about 40% of Australians report having experienced sexual and physical violence from the Personal Safety Survey, which is from the Australian Bureau of Statistics. But you will find that depending on which state that you're from, that some of those statistics may vary and the numbers may be slightly higher than that. And there is actually a gender difference as well in terms of prevalence as well.
So I'm going to talk a bit more about that. I mean, it is obviously really common, which is why we're here to talk about this stuff. The World Health Organization estimate that 1/3 of women are exposed to intimate partner violence at some stage in their lives. In Australia, we know that 1/4 of women, 1 in 4, and 1 in 13 men have been subjected to either sexual or physical intimate partner violence. And that was a recent survey by the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare. We also know that 50% of all children are exposed to at least one adverse childhood experience. So when you think of the number of people walking through your door every day, I want you to have a very different perspective on who's been through something traumatic. You know, it's likely to be close to 50% of the people walking through your door have been through something traumatic, whether it be family violence as an adult or whether it be childhood violence, but at some stage in their lives. So it's really common. So what I want to talk about then is, if it's really common, how do we approach it? So basically, the concept of trauma and violence-informed care is a concept that recognises that anyone who walks in your door potentially could have been through a traumatic event. You can't usually tell when they walk in your room whether they've been through a traumatic event or not. It's very difficult to tell if any individual have been through something traumatic. So it recognises that anyone could potentially have been through something traumatic. But this is not just about patients. It's actually about people in the whole organisation. So it recognises that staff members, doctors, registrars, it recognises that the cleaner, the accountant, anyone within an organisation could have potentially been through something traumatic. So the concept of trauma and violence-informed care is not just for a doctor and a patient relationship. It's for a whole organisation to actually be trauma-informed to reduce the risk of re-traumatisation for anyone in the organisation who's been through trauma and to increase psychological safety. And I'll tell you a little bit more about how we do that in a minute. So SAMHSA stands for Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's from the US Department of Health and Human Services. And they, in 2014, outlined a concept of trauma and violence-informed care that is used really widely. And so it makes 4 key assumptions about an organisation that is trauma-informed. First of all, the organisation, not just the individual, not just the doctor, but everyone in the organisation realises the potential impact of trauma. And I'll talk about impacts in a moment. It also recognises the signs and symptoms of trauma in patients, staff and students and registrars. It responds by applying trauma-informed care principles, and we'll talk about the principles, and it actively resists re-traumatisations of all people involved with the organisation. I'm going to talk a little bit about the potential signs and symptoms for people who've been through trauma. Now, this is specific for domestic violence against women, but it's actually not uncommon for anyone who's been through trauma to experience any of these sorts of things. We know that when family violence has been perpetrated against women, because it's much more common for women to have violence perpetrated by an intimate partner than it is men, but of course men can potentially be survivors of violence as well. They can suffer from physical, psychological, or reproductive effects. And so physical effects might be, you know, the obvious things. So the bruising, the black eye, the broken bone, the lacerations, other injuries. And they're the things that we all think of when we think of violence against women particularly. But what we often don't think of is the other things, like the psychological trauma. So it might be that your patient comes in with depression. And we know that 1 in 4 women who come in with depression are actually survivors of family violence. But we often don't know about it because we're not asking about it. So they may be presenting with anxiety or depression. They may be presenting with PTSD, with eating disorders, substance abuse. And we know that living with trauma is actually really unhealthy. So women who've been subjected to violence are more likely to have cardiovascular disease and hypertension. And also we think of things like the somatoform kind of complaints like irritable bowel, chronic pain, you know, chronic headaches, chronic abdominal pain, those sorts of things. And then of course the reproductive effects like, you know, unwanted pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections. And we also know that women who are subjected to violence when they are pregnant are more likely to have low birth weight babies and miscarriage as well. So from evidence taken specifically regarding domestic violence against women, but I just want to illustrate the fact that when anyone's been through something traumatic, they can present with psychological complaints, they can potentially have physical symptoms. We know that often people who have things like irritable bowel syndrome actually end up actually having other things going on from a psychological perspective. It would be important to explore trauma as a potential cause of some of these things as well. And of course, in children, the presenting complaints of children are many and varied, and of course they depend a lot on the children's age. But children that have been through trauma may present with bedwetting. They may potentially have been dry for some time and then restart bedwetting later on in life. They may have anxiety, stress or depression, behavioural issues. They may have problems at school. That's not to say that all children that have these things are necessarily going through trauma, but it's just a trigger, an indicator that makes you go, I need to consider the possibility that trauma might be occurring in this situation. And then again, those chronic somatic kind of complaints like the chronic pain or chronic abdominal pain. And in the older child, you might see things like drug and alcohol use, self-harm, and potentially things like suicidal ideation. So some of the symptoms and signs that you might look for in someone who's been through psychological or physical trauma. So we talked about the principles associated with a trauma-informed organisation. And I think this is really a key slide here. And this is also from SAMHSA. So first of all, safety. All people associated with the organisation feel physically and psychologically safe. And I want you to think of your organisation that you work for. Is your organisation a workplace that you feel physically and psychologically safe in your workplace? Trustworthiness and transparency. So maintaining trust with all people who are associated with it. And I think this is where it's really important to recognise that for many survivors, they've often been survivors of trauma, of family violence. They've often been blamed for what they've been through, and they've often been told it's their fault what they've been through. And I think maintaining trust with them, a part of that trust is to be not blaming them, but validating their experience and really understanding what it is that they've been through. And then the peer support, so lived experiences and stories promoting recovery and healing. So really acknowledging the stories, but not pressurizing people to talk about their stories if they're not ready to do that, but really acknowledging what they've been through, acknowledging how difficult it is, and acknowledging their strengths as well. Collaboration. So this sharing of power and decision-making when dealing with not just patients, but other staff members and anyone who's been through something traumatic is really important, because very often, so for instance, I mean, my field is working with family violence, and in family violence, it's basically about power and control. It's about a perpetrator having power and control over a victim survivor. And so this victim survivor has had her power and control taken away from her for a long time. And so to be sharing power with your patient or staff member who's been through something like family violence is very empowering. So the key here is empowerment of the survivor and allowing shared decision-making with that survivor as well. So giving them voice and control, so building on an individual's strengths and restoring power and control. So strengths-based, thinking of the things that the patient in front of you can do rather than the things that they can't do. And then cultural, historical and gender issues, which is really that sort of intersectionality, you know, considering marginalized groups, consider groups like the Indigenous population, migrant and refugee groups, LGBTQIA community, and the fact that these groups have often been marginalised and the effect that that can have, and generational trauma, for instance, in some of these groups is really significant, and the effect that this can have as well, and just acknowledging those things. Six key principles of a trauma-informed organisation, but we'll talk a bit more about practically what that means. So first of all, the whole of practice approach. So the idea, and I hope you've got the sense that this is about an organisation rather than about an individual. The psychological safety starts for a patient the moment that they make the phone call or that they book on Hot Docs or whatever app you use. That's the moment that the need for psychological safety starts, from the way that the staff take the phone call, make the phone call, make the appointment. So all staff should be trained in trauma-informed care, including non-clinical staff, and there should be procedures within the clinic around trauma-informed care as well. And having a place where, so then patients come along to the clinic, and having a place that then is a place that they feel comfortable. So what are some things you can do to make patients feel comfortable? Well, for instance, for patients who are survivors of family violence, having a poster that talks about family violence and the fact that you as a practice are wanting to support them is really powerful, because it says, we actually acknowledge family violence here and we know that this is a problem and we want to help you. And for example, in family violence, having brochures. You wouldn't necessarily put brochures in the waiting room because, of course, you know, it might be dangerous for a survivor of family violence to take them in the waiting room, but maybe in the bathroom or maybe given out by the doctor in the consulting room as well. Cultural sensitivity and training also is part of being trauma-informed as well. And safety is for staff as well. So just be aware of the risk of vicarious trauma in the work that we do. It is possible to have vicarious trauma through the difficult cases that we deal with, for, you know, not just us, for nursing staff as well, for receptionists, you know, who might be dealing with a really angry patient or something in the waiting room, to have processes in place to support these staff and to allow them to debrief where necessary. So processes for staff, I think, are really important. And you can even consider things like the possibility of having, if you're a practice owner, having family violence leave for staff members available to them in case they were in the situation that they actually needed to leave in a hurry and needed some time out from their job. So in a consultation, how does this look? Basically, the first thing is, and I've put it last, but really it should be first, which is communication, communication, communication. And you know, hopefully us GPs have had it hounded into us how to communicate with our patients and to use our active listening skills and really be patient-centered, to acknowledge what our patients have been through, to validate their experience, to believe our patients when they tell us they've been through something traumatic, which I think is really key and really problem. But also checking in with our patients, because sometimes talking about something traumatic can actually be quite re-traumatizing. So when I'm talking to patients about things that are quite traumatic, I'll just check in with them regularly saying, are you still okay to talk about this? Is this okay that we're talking about this right now? And just check in with them regularly to make sure that they're okay. And then at the end of a consult, if we've talked about something really heavy, just sort of summarizing and asking them if they need any further supports, because we've talked about something that could be quite difficult. I think what's also important is never pressurize someone to tell their story if they're not ready to tell it. Particularly when someone's been through something traumatic, if they're not ready to talk about it, do not put any pressure on them to talk about it. And be really aware that there are power imbalances, because as a doctor, we're in a position of power compared to the patient and how that might actually affect our patients. So as much as possible, that shared decision-making and that collaborative approach as well. And just, I think, being more aware of the fact that psychological trauma is so common, to be inquiring about the possibility of things like family violence within our patients, particularly family violence, I say, because if it's ongoing violence, we can actually help to do a risk assessment and safety planning and appropriate referrals to try and assist our patients to get into a safer situation. So that's why it's important to try and identify those patients who are going currently through family violence, but also people who've been through family violence in the past as well. So just very quickly, so how does this look when we're teaching? There is a concept called trauma-informed medical education, and it is exactly that. It's basically just taking all these trauma-informed care principles and it's using them as a medical educator. We don't know whether our registrars have been through traumatic events, and it may not be appropriate for us to potentially ask them whether they have, but it's to be aware that if 50% of the population have been through something traumatic, it's very likely that some of our registrars that we have come across us at some stage will have been as well. And it's to acknowledge that sometimes it's possible that them dealing with difficult situations that patients are going through could potentially be triggering or could actually cause them to develop vicarious trauma. And it's to really use these trauma-informed care principles when we're actually going through education. So, for instance, if we're going to be talking about a sensitive topic, check in with them. Are you okay with this? Just checking that you're okay for us to be discussing this at the moment. Giving out support details if you feel that you need to. Trigger warnings if you're going to be bringing up a sensitive topic. Debriefing with your registrar or offering someone else to debrief with them if they feel that they need to do something like that. And ensure that you have had training in topics like family violence and child abuse so that you're prepared if your registrar comes dealing with any patients that have been through these sorts of things so that you feel well equipped to be able to deal with these things. So that's really the concept of trauma and violence-informed care. When you're teaching using trauma and violence-informed care, it's about leading by example. It's about showing that you actually acknowledge the importance of trauma and the effect that that can have on people, and the registrar will see you doing that, and they will learn from the way that you are actually acting and the way that you communicate and the way that you share power with your patients and that you are patient-centered and so forth. So I think that's all from me. Over to you, May.
So I know that was a lot of information that we've just taken in, but we thought that it'd be really important, maybe us looking at putting that into practice and having an opportunity for some case discussion. So, and what we're going to be discussing is this case example. So I recognise that not all of you are going to be GP supervisors, but I think it's still a really good opportunity for us to discuss this particular case scenario and consider what your situation might be and how that might actually impact you. The registrar has come to discuss with the supervisor, and let's say that they're going to have a planned amount of time that they're going to discuss this case with Sarah, who's disclosed difficulty with behavioural challenges with their child and an unsupportive partner. So it's come out that Sarah's partner, we're not coping, will speak in elevated tone of voice, they'll criticise, and they sometimes might even lash out at Sarah as well. So the registrar has come back because they've had a conversation about this case. They're concerned they really didn't feel like they've handled it well, they really weren't sure if they said the right thing, or and they weren't quite sure, and they have a lot of emotional distress which has come out about this. How would you as the educator handle this? And the other scenario is that you as a supervisor notice that you've been asked to see Sarah's partner as a patient of the practice in the following week. So you could consider, if you're the practice manager, that you might be handling some of the management about that. You might be a medical receptionist who might also be thinking about how you coordinate all the appointments. So just have a thought about how you might approach this.
So we talked a little bit about supporting the registrar in working out, is the registrar distressed by clinically what happened or potentially something personal. So we talked about how we might ask the registrar in a sensitive way by asking them, is something about this case bringing up strong emotions for you? Is that something that you'd like to talk about with me? And the other thing that we talked about is setting an example just regularly within the practice and having time to debrief difficult cases and also discuss issues like this where you're including the whole practice staff, so reception, practice managers, everyone, in terms of how you might manage difficult situations, all these potential cases where confidentiality could be an issue.
We thought actually the registrar, despite feeling everything hadn't gone swimmingly, had actually done remarkably well to go for a squeeze into the disclosures that they got. We felt that we needed to support the registrar with respect for their capacity and be reinforcing. And one of the big points, just to fit in, we thought a little bit of immediate safety planning and discussion around confidentiality and the difficulty that that case situation raised for everybody in general practice, but how important it was to be respectful and recognise the situation as remarkably complex.
We've felt the importance of reassuring and normalising the fact that everyone would find a case like this difficult, and reassuring the registrar that, you know, as a supervisor, we would also find this a potentially complex case as well, to reassure them, to also acknowledge that it's a complex situation and to see how the registrar feels. Have they been through any past trauma or experiences that could have contributed to how they're feeling at the moment?
One of the main things I think we got out of it was that even though the registrar feels distressed, perhaps they didn't know what to do, the fact that they, you know, listened to this patient and indicated that they believe them when they're potentially making the first disclosure of this sort of thing goes a long way to setting up trust and rapport, to sort of build on future appointments, to make a plan. And again, we discussed a little bit about that initial safety assessment. And we also spent some time talking about systems and appointment times, and with the partner coming in, making sure that follow-up isn't at the same time and that addressing which would be the most appropriate provider.
We said many of those things that have been said before, that we need to set up a time so that we had time to listen to the patient and give them time to talk, validating the patient, and that this initial consultation was just a starting point, and that engaging them and getting them back was really important, and to look at who was there to support Sarah and who was there that might be supporting the child.
Yeah, well, I think it was a common theme around acknowledging the registrar did actually a lot well, and the positives in identifying the issues and actually exploring them to some degree. I think that notion of a form of words, so how to actually explore the issues with the registrar, and even having a form of inquiry, almost just of a practice script while the supervisor's debriefing the registrar as they're having some time out, which I thought was nice in terms of the practice manager or reception staff being involved. And lastly, a really, I think, important point around international medical graduates and some of the cultural differences and the potential that they've been subject to significant traumas of a different nature potentially, and being aware of that and how we can apply a preventative approach to registrars coming into the practice.
Thanks, Simon. I think a lot of the things which have been spoken about, there's a real common theme about ensuring safety, ensuring that for the persons in the room and the clinical aspect, but also for the registrar and the practice as well. We were a little bit more pragmatic as well. So I do want to acknowledge one really important point, that you didn't have to have all of the knowledge and have all of the skill set about trauma-informed care, that you could build up that repertoire as long as you were being open to listening and engaging. And I thought that was a really important point from the registrar, that you didn't have to feel like you had full expertise to still feel like you were making a difference. And then also just going back into the pragmatic, like even just the logistics of the day, to make sure, a really important point was making sure, is this registrar still okay to even continue with the day? You know, how do you manage the practical issues about managing their distress and a chat about are they okay in the moment? And then working out then how you're going to have a further conversation about that. Other thoughts that we came up with, which would be really important to be considering about trauma-informed education and trauma-informed care as a practice in this setting, would be, as mentioned, the safety assessment. The supervisor needs to be very clear that they're supporting the registrar to ask the right questions. And as we were saying, you know, building up that expertise, but also reinforcing their skill set in what they have is really important. And also being conscious that you might need to also be thinking about what you're doing to support the family. And that also includes the child as well. So that might also include other issues which come up about reporting and communications to other parties who'd be involved. We have touched on that as well, and Jenny's talked about the organisational structures. I think we need to be really clear that while as a supervisor, you might be seeing Sarah's partner and privy to information, you need to be conscious that you can't disclose what's actually told to you from the partner. So confidentiality is really important, but you still have to navigate about safety concerns. Sarah and a partner will need to have separate GPs, and how you plan this and inform Sarah and a partner that that's going to happen is really important. And that means that you may need to set up specific processes within the whole of practice about how to do that. So we have a list of resources which might help you about trauma-informed care. GPSA have a list of some really excellent fact sheets which might be really helpful. And then if you'd like to join us at the RACGP specific interest group, you'll actually find that there's a whole list of resources which also includes resources for supervisors as well, and resources for registrars, medical students, and we'll also direct you to the abuse and violence working with our patients in general practice, the white book. So if you can contact GPSI at racgp.org.au and just request access through the specific interest group, all of you will have access to those resources as well. As a GP registrar, it's great that they can speak to their supervisor, but I think it's also really important to think about debriefing with colleagues and peer groups. The Abuse and Violence in Family Seek have bi-monthly meetings and case discussions, which Libby and Bill are our peer group facilitators for that. The Psychological Seek also has peer groups, and Victorian faculty also has peer groups set up with that. Alison's also made a comment about encouraging people to contact their local PHN, as well as Hunter New England, CESPN and Blue Mountains have specific practice teaching on domestic family and violence that they'll run with everyone in the practice. Safer Families, RACGP, actually have whole of practice training for domestic family abuse and violence. So we also recognise that people might need their own individual support. So there are some specific resources for medical practitioners as well as online services. Now, the Staying Sane for Teens is actually a webinar that Professor Kay Wilhelm and I did myself, which looks at supporting teens and practice wellbeing. So you can access that webinar if you want to, about emotional resources as well. We're really happy for you to get in contact. So any questions, please feel free to contact us through GPSA, through the discussion boards, or through our emails. Really happy to be contacted.
Just to let people know about in our community platform, you're very welcome to join, essentially a chat platform. Any last comments or reflections from either of you?
Just to remind you guys that I know it's a big topic and I know we did it really quickly. You don't have to feel like you need to know everything straight away. We're here. Hopefully part of it is about having a community where we can share that. And hopefully this gives you some resources to feel more empowered for that. I want to thank everyone for coming.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.